Deepak Chopra, Wellness Radio, Sirius XM Stars, Sirius 102, and XM 155.
I'm Deepak Chopra and this is the Wellness Radio on the Sirius XM Stars channel, Sirius 102 and XM 155. Today we are live and you can listen to this program worldwide on your satellite radio, Sirius XM, Sirius 102 and XM 155. You can also find us on the internet. If you have an iPhone app, then you can find us there anywhere in the world. And the program will be repeated continuously till tomorrow morning. So if you miss out portions of it, come back. It will also be archived at deepakchopra.com and also soon be available at Times Network in India. So lots of ways to find us. As you know, on this program, we talk about spirituality, relationships, love, success, health and well-being. Always our favorite topic, consciousness. And today I have a surprise for you because I'd scheduled Stuart Hameroff and Robert Thurman and then coincidentally found my friend Dr. Dean Ornish in New York, and he's joining me live in the studio as well. I'd like to first welcome, though, my guest Dr. Stuart Hameroff to the program. And I want to tell everybody about you, Stuart. Are you there?
Yes, good morning, Deepak. Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice. And so much has happened in the last few weeks. It's just amazing.
Together, it was great.
Yeah, and I continue to learn from you. So I just want to tell my audience a little bit. And by the way, today we are live, so it's going everywhere live. Dr. Stuart Hameroff is a physician. He's a researcher at the University Medical Center in Tucson, Arizona. He also heads a conference yearly because he's the head of an organization and heads a center for consciousness studies. Dr. Hameroff is, as I said, an anesthesiologist by training, but then through a series of very interesting coincidences, which maybe he can tell us about, he ended up being with Sir Roger Penrose, who, for those of you who don't know, Sir Roger Penrose is the thesis advisor of Stephen Hawking. And Dr. Hameroff and Roger Penrose have a theory of consciousness that invokes suggests that consciousness enters the brain or is or at least collapses in the brain through structures called microtubules. And these are molecular structures in the within the neurons, and they apparently do 10 to the power of 27 computations per second. It's mind-boggling. Dr. Hameroff therefore feels that consciousness is embedded or linked to space-time geometry at Planck scale, and this is a level where charge, spin, mass, gravity, curvature of space-time, and everything that we call reality exists as a superposition of possibilities entangled. And he told me that it also unfolds holographically and scales up into the whole universe. Have I portrayed this accurately, Stuart?
Very well, Deepak. Thank you. Yeah, the idea basically is that quantum processes in the microtubules inside the neurons of the brain are actually the same thing as fluctuations in space-time geometry, connected to them, very intimately connected to them. And Roger Penrose developed the quantum space-time idea and is one of the eminent authorities in describing what the fabric of the universe, the most basic level of the universe at Planck scale, as you referred to it, at that level, quantum gravity, quantum geometry, it's an old idea. Twister theory is now connecting to string theory. So there's a lot of interesting developments. But Roger basically described the geometry of the universe at the most basic level, where everything is embedded, including, we think, at least the precursors to conscious experience, feelings, experience. And as you said, everything's entangled non-locally, spatially, and at higher and higher scales, which is how we connect to it.
And for our listeners, Planck scale is, you told me, 20, 25 times the magnitude smaller than the atom, right?
Correct. 25 orders of magnitude smaller than atoms. So materialist views are really irrelevant because if you go down to the level of the Planck scale, the basic level of the universe, then it's way below matter even exists. So, and matter, Einstein suggested, and Penrose also talks about, is can be thought of as curvature in space-time. So everything is space-time geometry. And Roger's other tremendous contribution was to suggest that information, and actually platonic information, mathematical truth, aesthetic values, ethical values perhaps, are embedded as patterns in this fundamental level. So, and from your standpoint, you could think of this as cosmic wisdom embedded in the universe.
Yeah, as you speak, I realize that what you call quantum entanglement, or others call acausal non-local quantum mechanical interrelatedness, or non-locality, or what you call the space-time geometry at Planck scale, in the Vedanta we call that Brahman.
Right. Brahman is the ground of being, the underlying source of everything. And you could think of that as space-time geometry. In fact, I gave a talk last year at the non-duality conference on Brahman and Atman are alive and well in quantum space-time geometry.
Oh, that's so lovely to hear. Now, you know, one of the things that I asked you, and I want to clarify this because, you know, maybe sometimes people get confused because we might be using terms a little differently. So when I asked you, does the universe exist in the absence of consciousness, you said most certainly, otherwise that would be solipsism. And, you know, when I use the word consciousness as Brahman, I think I'm referring to you to it as what you call proto-consciousness, because, you know, I think you refer to consciousness as once it's already at the subject-object split with perception and experience.
Yeah, I think it's a terminology. What you call consciousness, which is everywhere, and Brahman embedded in the universe, I would call, and Roger and I refer to it as proto-consciousness, or the precursor of consciousness, which is when...
Before conscious experience.
Well, it's prior to collapse. We think consciousness is actually a sequence of discrete events, like photons or quanta, that they're discrete units or events, because it's actually a process, like a photon. So, and you have a spectrum of them, high intensity, low intensity, but until the proto-consciousness, or the space-time geometry and superposition, reaches a particular threshold and self-collapses, it would stay proto-conscious, or kind of like dreams in our minds, in the unconscious, normally subconscious, which can sometimes merge with consciousness.
Mm-hmm. So basically, you know, again, you're validating what Vedanta says, because Vedanta says Brahman interacts with its own self to produce Brahman, which is the universe. And that Brahman, when it interacts with its own self, it in a sense collapses into both the observer, the process of observation, and that which is observed, simultaneously differentiating into all these different observers. But, you know, consciousness is a singularity, as Schrödinger said, without a plural. So just like electricity can manifest in my light bulb, in my radio, and my cell phone, consciousness through sentient beings observes the universe in different modes of observation. The self-collapse that you talk about is actually Brahman collapsing on its own self.
Yeah, and perhaps you can say Brahman collapsing into Atman, if I have that term right.
No, you do have it right.
So it's kind of like we were talking about this earlier, about if you think of an ocean surface with waves, when only at certain times do the waves collapse, like when they crash on the beach, and that would be a moment of consciousness. But still, you have all these waves and ripples and at least proto-consciousness going on everywhere in the universe, if quaya are embedded in the Planck scale, as we suggest.
Yes. In fact, those qualia are what give us the experience of the material universe. The material universe, with the absence of this proto-consciousness, would be unmanifest, wouldn't it be? It would be just the superposition of possibilities.
Yeah, well, the thing is, like when you say this is what how we see, you know, then you have to say, well, what is we? Because we is the consciousness itself.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a bit of a sort of depends on your interpretation of quantum mechanics. I think from, for example, Robert Lanza's work, and I think from things you've said, you more or less take a, in the physics context, the Copenhagen interpretation where the observer is causing the collapse.
Unless the observer is the universal observer.
Right, but so the universe, the observer is built in. So we would that the event itself is the observer, or is a moment of observation.
Okay, I get it. So every just like we, when we see a movie with several frames, we see continuity. We see the world as a continuity, but it's these happenings, as you call them, what haps that what's his name. The German physicist calls, you call them, I don't know what you call them, these moments of...
Well, moments of consciousness, objective reductions in the physics term, which is a type of self-collapse of the wave function. The philosopher Whitehead called them occasions of experience embedded in a wider field of proto-conscious experience. That's what Whitehead said 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, you know, our view, and I think also the Vedantic view that you talk about.
Mm-hmm. The qualia experience then is a moment of consciousness, because the qualia is a sound or a thought or a flavor or a feeling or a color, right?
Yes. Well, I would say a moment of consciousness incorporates or entangles different types of qualia. This is called the binding problem in the brain, where you have a color, sound, motion.
All coming together.
Coming together in a moment of consciousness. Even a vision has color, motion, shape, and then meaning bounding together into one concept.
Mm.
So multiple qualia components go into a moment of consciousness.
Wow, and they're all entangled in a sense, right?
They have the entanglement gives you a unitary conscious experience.
Right. You know, at that Caltech debate, I was taken to task for suggesting that biology is not a good example of entanglement, but you sent me these papers on mitosis, which suggests that morphogenesis and differentiation may be an entangled process, and how we, in fact, experience the body as a whole. Binding is just not in the brain. The whole body is, in a sense, expressing that kind of bounding, binding, doing all these hundreds of thousands of activities every second and correlating them with each other.
Yes, in fact, I think you need entanglement in phenomena like gamma synchrony EEG.
Mm.
You know, we think there are roughly 40 conscious moments per second in the brain correlating with a type of EEG called gamma synchrony.
Mm.
And you know the work from Davidson's lab that showed that the Tibetan monks who meditated went from 40, which is where normal people are, up to 80 at higher frequency, higher intensity. So that's the number and intensity of conscious moments per second. Now, in the movie analogy, you mentioned there are a certain number of frames which are discrete, but we experience them as continuous. But in that case, you do have an outside observer.
Right.
I think what may be happening is that each frame itself, in the movie analogy, is actually is like a quantum of consciousness, or a moment of consciousness, or a hap, or a occasion, as Whitehead calls it, and that has the consciousness built in. So.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a wave on the big ocean, a moment of consciousness out of, you know, the vast totality of proto-consciousness, at least. And then a series of those is what gives us our experience of a continuous world.
You know, Stuart, I can't tell you how grateful I am to be talking to you and getting all these wonderful insights.
And likewise, and I want to thank you. I just got the package of books. And it's fantastic, and so many of them look interesting. So
no, I'm looking forward to our continued collaboration, and you very graciously are coming to New York on the 28th, so I'm very thrilled about that. So I'll tell you more about that later.
Right.
But just so happy to have this association with you. So, you know, I happen to have Dr. Dean Ornish with me in the studio. He's a friend of mine, and, you know, many, many years ago he pioneered reversal of heart disease, and now he's talking about genetic non-determinism, how telomeres can lengthen themselves. And in many ways, even, you know, he's out there pioneering this great work on reversal of heart disease, reversal of prostate cancer, gene regulation, telomerase. And what I'm sensing right now is that his work actually, in a sense, will validate everything you're talking about, because the physical body, including our nervous system, ultimately is a process in this deeper proto-consciousness. And once we don't look at these structures in our body as structures, but as processes, because they're ever changing, then we'll have a new, totally new model for explaining things like disease and remissions and so on. I'd like to welcome Dean and say hello to Dr. Hameroff here.
Yes, thank you. I too sort of am so inspired by your work. And like Deepak, I believe...
I'm having trouble hearing, Dean.
Okay, so you use my microphone.
Okay. So, Stuart, I was just saying that I'm really inspired by your work and feel privileged to be on the show with you.
Likewise, it's nice to talk with you.
And part of what we've learned is that disease, as Deepak has said for many years, I think really begins in our consciousness and then only later manifests in the body. And to the extent that we can return to that proto-consciousness, to use the movie analogy, it's like the light behind in the projector behind the different frames that then takes that light and puts it into all the different names and forms and the dualities and so on. And to the extent that these spiritual practices can give us that direct experience of what you call proto-consciousness, I think it's really healing.
Yeah, I agree. And I think modern medicine overlooks the problem of what life actually is, you know, kind of just denigrated to a series of biochemical and physiological processes. But there's some under, and I think it's a quantum field that is essentially the same as what we've been calling proto-consciousness, mediated through biomolecules. And I just want to make one point of when, there's been evidence lately that there is quantum coherence and quantum entanglement in biological systems at normal temperatures, namely in photosynthesis, but it's still in proteins. And if plants figured out how to do it, then I think animal cells, especially the brain, have evolved processes to utilize this underlying quantum process, and I think that's what life basically is.
Well, in the samadhi experience, those Tibetan monks that you mentioned, they go at 80, gamma synchrony goes up to 80, and time slows down. Am I right?
Yes, I think if the number of conscious events you have per time increases. Like if you're in a car accident and the car is spinning, everybody says time slows down. It's because you're actually going faster and the outside world is staying the same. So your conscious perception is that the world has slowed down.
I think that's such a beautiful thought and almost a metaphor for how dynamic the biological processes are and how much more dynamic they are than we had once realized. As Deepak mentioned, we found that in just 3 months, over 500 genes could change their expression and affect upregulating or turning on the disease-preventing genes and down-regulating the genes, particularly the RAS oncogenes that promote breast cancer and prostate cancer and chronic inflammation and oxidative stress and so on.
Wow.
So I think your work is really providing a theoretical basis for the underpinnings of the kinds of changes that we're observing.
You know, I was talking to a quantum optics guy yesterday, and he was telling me how amazing are the quantum properties of DNA, are the photonic, the optical properties of DNA. They seem to be able to utilize photons. And they're actually using it artificially. But the bigger question is that's what's going on, you know, in biology. Is it some kind of quantum optical process regulating genes? And, of course, you know, if you're upregulating or downregulating, that involves differentiation and all that, which nobody really understands very well. And I think there could be some kind of quantum field process going on at this level that kind of is at least in tune, if not regulating the biology.
See, the work of Dean Ornish with telomerase, and incidentally he worked on this with the one who won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, Dr. Blackburn, Elizabeth Blackburn.
Who won the Nobel Prize last year for her work on telomerase. But, you know, I think starting this dialogue between yourself and people like Dean Ornish and others, we're actually getting not only the theoretical understanding, but the practical implications of this.
That's right.
And as you were speaking right now, I said, you know, I was going, just my mind was going in a different direction when you spoke about photosynthesis, which is basically the basis of all life on our planet, is dependent on quantum entanglement and collapse of possibility waves.
Exactly.
Well, let me know when you're in San Francisco. I'd love to show you what we're doing. It'd be fun to spend some time together.
Fantastic. I will do that for sure.
And, you know, so there's maybe some relevance to the statement, God said, let there be light, and there was light.
You know, it's funny you say that. I was reading an article this morning about the nature of space-time geometry and how Roger Penrose's twister theory, which is an old theory he had, which kind of got eclipsed by the string theory, that the string theorists ran into a roadblock, and now they're incorporating twister theory. And twister theory is basically that the universe is made of light, and and that in these kind of spiral, very beautiful patterns. So it could be.
You know, I will send you a paper. I will make a note of it. Many years ago, when I was traveling in the Netherlands, I met this scientist. He was a neuroscientist by the name of Hermes Romain. I don't even know if you're familiar with the name, but he was the head of the Neuroscience Institute in the Netherlands in Amsterdam. He gave me two papers that I still treasure. I've read them over and over again. In fact, I dedicated my book, How to Know God, to Dr. Romain, who then he's passed on since then. But one of the papers that he gave me, which I'm going to send to you, was that photons are the carriers of information, which of course is true. I mean, when I use my BlackBerry or send you email or text message you, I'm basically manipulating photons. But he said photons are also the carriers of subjective information, because every time you think a thought, you you have a synaptic firing, which is basically photons. And so he said, since photons are the carriers of both objective and subjective information, and since they permeate the whole cosmos, then that implies that the universe is imbued with subjectivity. It's an obscure paper published in a reliable journal in Europe. I'm going to send it to you and wonder what you think of it.
I don't think synaptic transmissions use photons.
Well, electromagnetic. They are electromagnetic phenomena, aren't they?
Well, most synapses are chemical neurotransmitters, but there's also electrical synapses, gap junctions. And
okay.
I think there are photons in the biomolecules, which kind of are self-contained.
Okay.
In fact, that's probably what mediates quantum entanglement. So I think there are more photons than he even imagined, if he's just thinking of the synapses.
Interesting.
And like I said before, they relate to DNA also, and they seem to be involved in this quantum coherence entanglement business.
Mm-hmm.
And one more point is that...
But tell me, I don't want to lose that thought. Do you think you do think that the universe is imbued with subjectivity at the level... Of course, you've said that.
Right.
At the level of proto-consciousness to conscious moments.
But photons do carry more information than just their frequency and wavelength. They have orbital momentum and angular momentum, and within them, and polarization is one example. And the structures in the eye, the cilia between the inner and outer segments of the rods and cones, may be able to extract quantum information that goes directly into subconsciousness in the brain, or consciousness even, in addition to the color and wavelength striking the rhodopsin in the very back of the eye. So there may be a lot more information we're getting from photons in vision and ambiently in the universe that are not we're not directly conscious of, but kind of are part of the subconscious or sort of background.
Wow. Well, Dean, anything you want to say?
No, I just enjoy listening to you talk, so it's very inspiring to hear you.
Well, let me just say to Dean that I admire your work greatly, and I've always been more interested in terms of mitosis and cell division in the mitotic spindles and the centrioles, rather than the DNA and... Because one possibility is that problems in mitosis per se, rather than initially in the genes, would cause abnormal genotypes. So this is an old theory of 100 years ago from a German guy named Boveri, who said that abnormal mitosis results in abnormal genotypes, which then some of which can be malignant, which raises the question of how normal mitosis works and how it's so precise and divides the chromosomes perfectly, because if not, then you have an abnormal genotype, and that can be malignant. So I think that this quantum entanglement in mitosis, in the microtubules, and particularly centrioles...
In normal mitosis.
Normal mitosis. Mm. You need that. And the centrioles are actually perfectly sized to be quantum optical devices. So I think there could be photons involved in mitosis, well, in all biological processes. But mitosis is a particularly good example, because the centrioles do detect and respond and utilize photons. That's been shown in other contexts.
So it's basically a confusion of cause and effect, then, is what you're saying, that the mitosis, abnormalities in mitosis cause abnormalities in genes, as opposed to the other way around.
Happen that way. It could happen both ways. Probably happens both ways. But I think it points to that there's a lack of understanding of mitosis. I mean, they think of it as kind of a mechanical machine-like thing with the microtubule spindles walking along each other, along with actin. But I think it's more exotic and elegant than that, and probably utilizes quantum optics and quantum entanglement.
So, Stuart, the microtubules are in all the cells, not just the neurons, right?
Right.
Correct. They're in all cells, all animal cells, and there's something like them in plant cells also. Mm-hmm. But all animal cells. People always say, well, if I got microtubules in my kidney or in my rear end, why isn't that conscious? And so I get that question a lot, and the answer is that only in the brain do we have. And I think those tissues are proto-conscious or have quantum coherence, but only in the brain do you have the proper conditions to reach self-collapse and have consciousness.
I don't know about you, my rear end is very conscious.
I think when you talk about consciousness, you're talking about conscious moments at the level of perception, I think. So that's
right. Well, reaching this threshold, kind of yes. Like, you know, the waves which crash and give white caps versus the waves which kind of undulate up and down.
I'm curious, you know, in closing, what do you think about Craig Venter's recent experiments synthesizing a genome and inserting into a cell?
A little worrisome. I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about all this transhumanism and merger of biology and technology. A lot of it, I think, is naive in terms of the AI, artificial intelligence, building brains. And then when it gets to the genes, I don't know enough about it to really, you know, except to be slightly worried. I do think that as far as consciousness goes, that the only hope to have a conscious machine would be if it was a quantum device, but that's another story.
But even a conscious machine would be an extension of human consciousness. So it doesn't alter the fact that you need consciousness to create consciousness, or which is already happening anyway.
Yeah, it would be another manifestation, like animal consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think computers will automatically be conscious just because they have a high complexity of computation.
Right. Well, Stuart, great to have you. I'll see you at the end of the month in July. And once again, very grateful for our collaboration and association.
Well, thank you, Deepak. And Dean, nice talking with you.
Likewise. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm Deepak Chopra, and Dean Ornish is going to stay in the studio with me for some time. And we'll be right back.
Deepak Chopra, Wellness Radio, Sirius XM Stars, Sirius 102, and XM 155.
Welcome back. I'm Deepak Chopra, and this is Wellness Radio on the Sirius XM Stars channel, Sirius 102, XM 155. On this program, we talk about spirituality, relationships, love, success, health and well-being, always about consciousness. And my next guest is a wonderful friend, a great mentor, and somebody that I love a lot, whose name you should be familiar with. Robert Thurman. How are you, Robert?
I'm fine, Deepak. How are you?
I'm great.
How nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice. And you can say hello to Dean Ornish, who's sitting in the studio with me.
Oh, Dean, how are you? Great to see you.
You know, Bob, it's so funny. I had a dream about you last night, and it told me that I should call you, and I had no idea why. And then I was talking with Deepak this morning, and one thing led to another, and
there
here
you
we
are.
That's fantastic.
Synchronicity all over again.
Family's doing very well. We have a little baby girl who's just 11 months old now.
I know. She's so beautiful. I remember seeing her when she was practically newly born. That's wonderful.
Well, fortunately, she takes after her mom. We're all very grateful for that.
So I want to tell our audience that I saw you a week ago or so in the apartment, and you shared with me this beautiful book that you've written, Why the Dalai Lama Matters.
Oh, yes.
And,
right.
And I want to bring that in context of the very special project that you're doing, that you've asked me to be involved in next year in New Jersey. So let's start. You know, you've been with His Holiness the Dalai Lama for years and years. You've taught religion at Columbia University, written several books on Buddhism. Tell us about why you wrote that last book.
Well, I've known His Holiness, I hate to say, for 46 years.
Oh, my God.
Dates me in a very, very elderly echelon, although I feel just as youthful as I am.
Yeah, we're all biologically different than our chronological age.
I know, luckily. But anyway, I wrote that book in early part of 08, late 07, 08, although I have been writing it for years. But I pulled together that version in early 08 because the world was focused on the Tibetan situation because of the Olympics, you know, and the Tibetans, the poor things, were getting themselves in terrible trouble. I knew they would kind of with the Chinese who don't tolerate nonviolent protests. And it was really a dire time. And what discouraged me or made me unhappy was that I noticed that even people who support Tibet have lost hope. You know, they are despaired. And I feel one of the major problems on the planet, why we haven't managed to control the militarists who are driving all of our countries to the brink, and the planet to the brink, is that we all feel we can't, and we have a sense of sort of, you know, what Thoreau said almost two centuries ago now, the mass of men today lead lives of quiet desperation, I think still holds. And so that book is an attempt to kindle hope by seeing that one of the most intractable problems in the world, the Tibet-China problem, is actually tractable. It could be settled very easily if people had a will to settle it. The problem with these kind of problems is there's one party that thinks they're benefited by not settling it and living in denial and encouraging others to be in denial, and so they don't. But actually, they're mistaken in that they think they're benefiting by not settling. They'd benefit so much more by settling. So what I did is I showed a win-win situation for China and Tibet, and I showed how the kind of creative thinking and loving thinking and wise thinking that the Dalai Lama represents, it's politically and socially practical as well and can be applied to every problem. And those who are currently not solving problems and continuing violence and so on in order not to solve them, because they think they benefit, actually are not benefiting nearly to the extent they would if they solved them. And I even promise actually to the president of China, Mr. Hu Jintao, that he would have a Nobel Peace Prize if he would solve the problem and become friends with the Dalai Lama and relent on the treatment of the Tibetan people. And he would, he would be a Gorbachev without losing the Ukraine. He would get a Nobel Peace Prize. He'd be beloved by his own people. He'd be beloved by the Tibetans and the world. And it would be really something wonderful for him. Meanwhile,
he's in the silly position. He's, I think, in the bottom 10 of world leaders of unpopularity, right along with Gaddafi and Ahmadinejad. And this after the Olympics and the Shanghai Expo and all kinds of PR that the Chinese have tried to put out, he's still very unpopular. And the Dalai Lama's in the top 10, up there with the Pope and Angela Merkel and, I don't know, maybe you, Deepak.
No, come on.
So anyway, it's just a win-win. You know, I think we have to learn to think and imagine in terms of win-win. And then even if we lose, we feel we've done our best. We visualize victory, and we tried our best to win it. And, you know, for the time being, we don't. But, you know, next life, you know, whatever.
I'm speaking to Robert Thurman, a professor of religion, Columbia University, author of Why the Dalai Lama Matters. You know, listening to Sirius XM Stars, Sirius 102 and XM 155. You can get us on satellite, on the internet, on your iPhone app, and we're going worldwide right now, and you'll be able to listen to this program all day today, right through tomorrow. So if you missed any portion.
Isn't that wonderful? Really,
yeah,
worldwide.
Absolutely. Well, with Bob Thurman, how can we do any less?
Hello, thanks, Deepak. That's so nice. That's
so,
really great.
So, Bob, tell us about this huge endeavor you've taken on for the city of Newark with Mayor Cory Booker.
Yes, well, I met a lovely young man named Drew Katz, who has a foundation called Infinite Possibilities, which anybody who has infinite in the name, I always love it. It's one of my favorite concepts. I always feel released by it, you know. And then I met him, and we did a peacemaking power of nonviolence conference in 1997 in San Francisco with Mayor Willie Brown and Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. That was a huge benefactor of many people. Thousands of people found their life changed by it, in which the Dalai Lama invited all kinds of people from the inner city in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, all sorts of places, to get together with meditative and spiritual types and other Nobel Prize winners. And then the citizens of San Francisco joined, and it was a wonderful, uplifting thing, showing that hopeless situations are not hopeless, actually. And people on the ground dealing with them are full of energy, full of guts, and they don't resign themselves to any kind of apathy or denial. And it was really great, and we've been trying to do one ever since. But I met Drew Katz, and he
heard
about
Drew's
it.
A good friend of mine, too. He traveled with me before.
He's a disciple of yours, Deepak. He started off his spiritual thing, actually, in one of your retreats.
Yeah, I remember, yeah.
And that was one of the points on which we met. And anyway, when he heard about this conference, he said, oh, I want you to come and do it in Newark. I'm a great friend of Cory Booker. Cory Booker is also a student of Deepak. And Cory Booker is trying to turn around the violence, the reputation and reality that Newark has faced in the past. He's a Yale and Stanford graduate, but he lives in a project, and he goes out on night patrol.
And he's the mayor of Newark.
Mayor of Newark. And I'm sure Cory would die with joy to bring Dalai Lama. And indeed, that was the case. We went to see Cory. He was totally excited about it. And Tibet House does this, our nonprofit that we have, because Tibet House mission is to show the virtue of Tibetan culture as a mediating, peacemaking culture with all kinds of strategies, from meditation to art making to dialogue to critical thinking to positive thinking, and all of these strategies to try to make peace and to preserve nonviolence. And so we're putting it together now with your help, Deepak, and we're we're dealing with it on five levels: nonviolence within the individual, nonviolence within the family, nonviolence in the community, nonviolence between nations, and nonviolence with nature and with animals and with the planet, five levels of nonviolence.
And the conference is already scheduled for March. May 13th through 15th next year, 2011. So say it again,
May 13th to 15th,
and we'll soon have a website, and we'll be announcing it on our website. And we're going to be doing some very solid research. I'm talking to Gallup to look at things like crime rate before and after, because we'll be doing all these wonderful meditations. And it's going to be quite an event. I spoke to Victor Chan. in Vancouver, and he wants to be involved and help you.
Yes, with his Dalai Peace Foundation, we welcome his participation.
Yeah, so he'll be getting in touch with you, and hopefully we'll bring also some other Nobel laureates.
We have an invitation out to Wangari Maathai and Desmond Tutu, and they're trying to arrange their schedules, and maybe Muhammad Yunus.
Okay.
And a few others.
I had the opportunity to meet the mayor of Hiroshima, Mayor Akiba, who heads an organization of 3,000 mayors for peace across the world. And he's very interested in being part of this as well.
That's wonderful. Yes, we hope to link it up and actually get the media going. We're like the radio. It's a worldwide event, actually, although happening in its root is in Newark. But it will be a worldwide event through the group of mayors. Jonathan Granoff of the Nuclear Nonproliferation and the Nobel Peace Prize Laureate Summit organization is also working with us on that. And
yes.
So it's very exciting. And we hope to mobilize again. We have to, it's key, even here in our country, we all united, a lot of people united in a visionary way behind the extraordinary upset victory of Obama. And then, of course, we've found that it's very, very hard to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there's a danger of people giving way to despair again and sort of, oh, why bother? It never works. Nothing happens. And we mustn't do that. We must always work, even as a Democrat, as a Republican, as an independent, whatever we are. We have to never give up hope, never give up in the face of intractable vested interests, and continue to push for the good and push for the reasonable. And this is the case, I was pleased to see today where Kevin Costner has invented a machine, or his colleagues have, that separates oil from water, and they're going to deploy 32 of them in the Gulf. I saw this on Huffington Post.
No, wonderful.
I hope that works.
Yeah, no, I met Kevin. He's always interested in coming up with new inventions. And last time I met him, he was showing me an armband that can immediately paralyze an assailant and GPS the information to the nearest police station.
Really?
With a tranquilizer. And all you have to do is wear it around your arm.
I agree.
So Kevin's totally into all this stuff. Listen, so because we have Dean Ornish here, and we had Stuart Hameroff, who's a colleague of Sir Roger Penrose, expert on consciousness.
Oh, great.
And he was talking about how Buddhist monks in meditation have a phenomenon called gamma synchrony, where they have, instead of the normal person having, neurons firing at 40 hertz, the Buddhist monks fire at 80 monks. So there are more conscious moments per second, double the number of conscious moments.
I'm sure that's true. That's
wonderful. And so the more conscious movements they have, the slower time becomes to them in comparison with people who are having lesser conscious moments. This has huge implications.
I think that's true. There's another element, I think, also that monks like that train themselves to raise their body temperature at will.
Yes.
And this boosts the immune system enormously, like giving yourself a conscious fever that isn't damaging to you but drives out any kind of, unpleasant microbial life that would cause you harm.
Yes.
And even helps you, there's even research that this might help you develop resistance to things like anthrax or plague or other kinds of very dangerous diseases. And there's research going on in that line, which is great. Dean, have you looked into this sort of thing? I'm sure you have.
I know that Herb Benson has done some work on the Tummo yogis that can melt snow around them for those kinds of things, and documenting
the original documentation, but the sort of benefits in a medical sense for a non-highly trained person to learn to do this a little bit, just a little bit, not to the degree that the adepts do, that this could boost immune system. I think he's not been working in that direction, but he may begin to also. It's very important.
What I find even more interesting is how even in the cities of being able to raise body temperature and melt snow and so on.
Right.
But to me, the most powerful city is the one that you so eloquently have been working on your whole life, which is the power of nonviolence and compassion and forgiveness.
Right, absolutely.
And so many studies have shown that really is whatever. It's not about condoning what the other person does, as you know. It's about freeing us from our suffering and how we can measure in so many ways that happens. And what I particularly want to just send you some admiration for is that because of it's so easy for people to say, His Holiness has been advocating nonviolence, and here it is all these years, and things aren't any better. Why don't we just pick up some arms and go shoot a few people? And the fact that you're planning this conference with Drew and the work that you're doing, saying, you know, in the scheme of things, that only perpetuates suffering, and to the degree we can stay in that nonviolent, forgiving place is really the only hope
but
that we
have.
But,
you know, I think actually recently there's been a lot of work on neuroplasticity with the four divine qualities that Lord Buddha talks about.
Oh, yeah.
Loving-kindness, compassion, joy at the success of others, and equanimity or peace of mind. Those four divine qualities change the structure of your brain.
They change the structure of your brain. They change the structure of your heart. You know, we find that people who have chest pain or angina multiple times a day, once they you know, the most toxic emotions are anger and hatred.
Uh-huh.
And to the extent that that can become more compassionate, it frees them from their pain. I'm curious, even in the context of the Chinese, you know, getting into Google system and looking at the email of human rights activists, you know, how do you maintain that place of compassion, and when it's so easy to go downwards into much more destructive emotions?
Well, you just have to love the Chinese people. They're really wonderful, and the government's behaving badly, but actually one loves even the bad government. This is the key, I think, of our nonviolent sort of inner revolution, global revolution that we need now, is that unlike angry revolutions, what I call hot revolution, they're cool revolutions, in that people love the people they are, however lovingly opposing, and don't want to do them violence, you know. And then this, you know, like, people laughed because Deborah Solomon, who does those interviews in the New York Times, laughed so much because I claimed, and it's true, that I try to meditate on how Dick Cheney was my mother. This was in the days of the Bush administration when we were sort of irritated with their warmongering. And I, you know, you have to visualize and imagine that even the person you dislike was your mother in a previous life, because we've all been intertwined with each other, infinite previous lives. It's a Buddhist meditation of compassion, how everyone is infinitely linked up. If you don't believe in previous life, you could do it by sharing molecules.
Well, we're calling it quantum entanglement today.
That's perfect. We can do it that modern way. But the point is, we're all totally interlinked, and there really are no bad guys. There's just bad habits. And so we want to help the bad guys get out of their bad habits, and we want to do it lovingly, with good humor, and happily. And the key is, nobody gives in to anger. And once we don't give in to anger, then the people who are angry will become less angry eventually, although we may have to absorb a little bit, which is the problem, but we have to be trained to do that. But on the other hand, I always like to say, Dean, that and Deepak, that people say, well, nonviolence hasn't gotten the Dalai Lama anywhere, but hey, well, how has violence gotten? Who's it gotten anywhere lately? You know, okay, World War II, maybe there was a good outcome in a sense, but then since then, nobody has been ever able to win anything. Vietnam, Korea, nobody won any war. Even Korea is still in a terribly destabilized condition. And Iraq, we've been there. Afghanistan, we've been there more than a decade. It's no better. And India and Pakistan have been going at it for 50 years. You know, Palestine has been 50 years. In other words, the violent thing is not working either.
Yes.
And Jesus and Buddha, 2,500 years ago, told us that it didn't work. Violence breeds more violence. But when are we going to listen, you know? We're finally now maybe going to listen, you know? We have to because the individual violence now, because of the technology amplifying anger so drastically, is so huge that we can't anyway go on with this idea of, well, we'll just get rid of that guy and everything will be cool, because then the people you hire to get rid of them, then they become bad guys, then you have to get rid of them, and it's an endless chain.
Yes.
And of course, in the Buddhist view, the reason you don't try to kill your enemy is that your enemy just takes rebirth and comes back at you, and you won't know which direction he's coming from next time.
Well, you know, it's like, you know, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But
that's
you mentioned,
right,
the technology, when we start talking about suitcase nuclear bombs, there's no defense against that, except to get the world to love us rather than to hate us.
Exactly.
And I remember the very first study that I did 33 years ago, I had 10 men and women in a hotel for a month. I was a medical student, and
yes,
one was a 75-year-old dentist who hated gay people, and one of the other men was gay, of course. And
yes,
they started yelling at each other, and they both got chest pain, and one took a nitro and the other took a Demerol, and I thought they were both going to have a heart attack and this would be the end of my very short research career.
No,
so I started talking to them. I said, you know, you're giving the power to give you chest pain and maybe even to die to the person you hate the most. There's a lesson there that's not very smart, even from your own, you know, this false choice of what's selfish and unselfish. You realize they're one and the same. And
you know, actually, Nelson Mandela has a good line there. He says, having a resentment against another person is like drinking poison and hoping it will kill your enemy.
That's a beautiful
Very
thing.
Very good line. That is perfect.
So I talked to them, and they got them to sort of doing little tasks for each other during the rest of the month, and they had no more pain. And so it was a really good lesson for me that ultimately what frees us from our own suffering is that kind of compassion.
That's totally great. And you know, in this line, I recently have been rereading and preparing for the conference. I reread Deepak's great book, Peace is the Way.
Oh, you're so sweet.
Deepak's got so many methods. And
absolutely.
Maybe you should say something, Deepak. You have so many great methods in there. And actually, didn't you say you were devoting everything to this from now on? This is your main thing.
I think I told you I'm going away to be a bhikkhu, and this is my last live program before that.
You're kidding.
Exchanging my BlackBerry for a begging bowl for a while. And I'll be better prepared when I come back. There are lots of methods, and they're all borrowed from these great wisdom traditions, including techniques for conflict resolution. So we'll talk, and we'll use them in our conference. But Bob,
listen, be careful, Deepak. If your bowl, when you're being a bhikkhu in the Buddhist monastery in Thailand, which I'm so Dean and I are wishing you off then.
Yes, you are actually. You are wishing me off.
Steve Jobs doesn't invent an eye bowl. Yeah. Start staring you in the face when you're eating your rice.
No, I'll be careful. Don't worry. I've got you on my side. So before we close the program. Talk a little bit about Tibet House for our audience and about the programs and the website.
Yes, well, Tibet House US is in New York, and the original Tibet House is in New Delhi. And because Tibet, the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan people in exile are seeking to liberate Tibet nonviolently, they don't want to, fight or do war or whatever. I mean, there have been some exceptions, but in the mainstream, they haven't. And His Holiness never approved any such thing. So therefore, the only way of liberating Tibet is by people realizing that it exists and coming to love it so much, that they, including the Chinese people, that they won't let it die, in spite of the fact that it's under a kind of genocidal threat. It has been for 50 years.
And you have a lot of cultural programs,
Exactly, and we want to show the beauty of the culture. We want people to fall in love with Tibet, and not only us, but there's Tibet House Mexico City, there's Tibet House London, Tibet House Tokyo.
And your website, Bob, we're going...
is tibethouse.org and tibethouseus.org, both of them, and menla.org. We have three different websites.
Okay.
A healing center upstate where we're trying to do Tibetan medicine, and we hope you and Dean will come up soon and do an event.
Indeed, but I want our listeners to check in on that website, tibethouse.com.org. Tibethouse.org. Thanks, Bob, for joining me. Till next time.
Love to the family.
Much love to you, Bob.
Dean, before we go, because we just have 2 minutes. I want our listeners to find out more about Spectrum and about the work you do.
Thank you.
So it's Dinosh.
Either ornish.com, ornish.com is probably the easiest one.
Okay, ornish.com, and the book is Spectrum, and it outlines all the ways you can actually influence your health, your well-being, reversal of heart disease, all the things about that Dean's been talking about regulating your genes. We are in a new era right now. We're talking to people from the spiritual domain, physicists like Stuart Hameroff, physicians. It's all coming together that the universe is structured in consciousness.
Yes.
Aham Brahmasmi. That's the message. We are the universe. And it's a powerful message. And I hope you'll come back to this program every Saturday. I've recorded a few programs before I go off to my monkhood experience. I'll be back in the end of July, and we'll continue with the program. In the meanwhile, keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars.
Thanks, Deepa.
Thanks. A is for acceptance. Today, I will accept myself just as I am. I will reaffirm that I'm a beautiful person just as I am. Today I will accept myself just as I am. I will reaffirm that I am a wonderful person just as I am. Today I will accept myself just as I am. I will love myself just as I am.
Today, I will say to the infinite divine being, the mystery that we call God, thank you, God, for making me just as I am. Knowing this, I will see the world just as it is. I will accept the world just as it is. And in the clarity of that awareness, I will feel peace, harmony, laughter, and love.
B is for bonding.